Today on our show, we are getting all indie on you
as we count down the top 10 A24 films.
Hit it! Welcome to episode 372 of the Countdown Podcast. My name is Wayne.
And my name is Paul. Welcome to the podcast. We count down movies and sometimes television in order of awesomeness so you don't have to. And as we have already summarized for you today, it's about independent cinema. Films that aren't out of the big mainstream studios. Films that have captured our attention and our love, our hearts, with their indiness.
Now, Paul, how do you feel about indie films? Are you like, is it just a good date? Or are you, I mean, how do you, I find that indie films, maybe 5% of them are watchable.
Oh, that means you must have struggled with today's list, my friend.
Oh, I struggled like a bit, my friend. Don't even worry about it. Yes, it was very difficult. Mainstream films, yes, a lot of them are shit too, but they are more watchable.
Well, I do tend to disagree. I think...
Really?
I have no problem. Obviously, you don't get the big splash, the big flash and all that kind of stuff when you watch an indie film. But what you do get is generally speaking, very well thought out, well written films, excellent performances, maybe not the wham, bam, thank you, man elements, but yeah, the stuff that gets under your skin a little bit more effectively. And that's really what my list celebrates today. Way more than that. Now, I want to add a little caveat here. In the previous sort of studio-based episodes that we've started doing, we made it so that they had to have made the film, not just distributed. A24 is primarily a distribution company, but it takes indie films. It doesn't distribute Sony or Disney
Avatar,
films, right?
Yeah.
It does other indie films. And that's the point of today's show, is to shine the spotlight on the 5% of films that Wayne reckons are good that are indie podcasts. I think they're better. There's a lot more than that. So we'll see how this list goes. But we are taking any A24 film they distributed or made. That's what we agreed upon. So, right, if you're like, fucking A24 didn't make that. That was bloody Film 4 Studios. All right, fine. But we're never going to do a top 10 Film 4 Studios.
There wasn't 10.
There we go. Okay. So without any further ado, then let's get into the show proper on the other side of this opener, which kicks off every show. It's called The Recount.
Who wants a recount? Who wants a recount? Who wants a recount? Who wants a recount?
The recount is our mailroom. Paul, what happened this week? Other than me getting COVID.
Oh, yeah. By the way, we should explain right?
Yeah, by the way, I'm on the Rona, baby. Like, I tested bad on Tuesday, mm-hmm. and so far hasn't killed me, so upsides, you know, that's nice.
It's not allowed to kill you.
It's pretty rampant in the old Perth these days.
It really is. We are really facing our Rona apocalypse at the moment.
I had held out hope that I would be one of the, like, fucking daywalkers, like, who could just not get it, right? I thought, wouldn't that be cool? And then you just Wesley Snipes-ing around, you know?
All the advantages, none of the disadvantages. Whatever that line of dialogue is.
I know one person who does seem to be immune. It's tennis shoes, Rachel.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Yeah, she can't seem to get it, even though everyone around her gets it. But no, unfortunately, I did get nailed. And so far, I'm doing okay, you know?
Let's assuage people's concerns so far.
Exactly. Working from home, I've had worse flus than this, knock on wood, but, you know, like, this is not as bad as one I had sort of 4 months ago, so it's, you know, I'm actually, like, I don't know if you can tell if I'm stuffed up or not. You probably can tell I'm a bit stuffed up at the moment.
Not a lot, I don't think.
Could be worse. Yeah, it was worse earlier on, so, you know, folks, just fight the good fight.
So we are recording from separate studios today, Studio A and Studio B, and I have not obviously braved seeing Wayne. Next week, hopefully, we'll be back in the same studio, and that's why you're not going to hear the soundboard today. So I actually want to do this now. Obviously, we're concerned for Wayne. That's very, very important. But arguably, the biggest loser today for all of you, and other than you, the audience, of course, is the soundboard, who is very sadly not with us. Because the soundboard...
Good riddance, asshole. You're a piece of crap. I realized Paul can't actually do that
it's
thing.
It's not the same show.
So it might be a good show, folks.
It's not the same show without it.
Yeah, it might be a better one.
In fact, maybe I'll just mute Wayne's track during this part. I know this isn't the countdown that you signed up for. I know... If this is your first episode, this is not a true representation of how amazing this show can be. Where we do climb the higher echelons of champagne sketch comedy. I mean, champagne not sketch comedy. And we're not going to get Wayne reacting the way that he would react to many
things. Oh, no, no. Many it's going to be great. It's going to be great. There's going to be no like awkward pauses where I try and kill Paul or any of that stuff. It's going to be great. It's
so
be great.
For 1 week at least, Valet, soundboard.
Fuck off.
And hopefully all okay. will be back to normal next week. All right, then. So let's get into it then. Let's start with an email very quickly from Joseph Doherty, who said, "Holy shit, Paul. I've had the same experience as you and Danny, the guy who emailed, with the colorful language when the pod starts playing. I had my four-year-old in the car. I turned it on and Wayne's saying, 'Now look at this cunt,' is blaring through the speakers." She didn't even react. We don't use that word here in the same way, so she's never heard it. She doesn't react to our swearing as it is, thankfully. Cheers from Joe.
Oh, God. So sorry, Joe, but thank you for listening.
Yes, absolutely. It's very funny. Now, on last week's show, episode 371 was the MCU ranked, which was a good episode, did well for us. Big surprise, people love the MCU.
Oh, they like the sea.
We ranked from 28 down, of course, to our number one. And I said, give us your hot takes from that episode. What? We're not going to sort of compare who had the better or worse list. Just tell us what really incensed you from that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what came back. Francis Booker said, "I enjoyed the new Doctor Strange a lot more than you guys, clearly. Without spoilers, an excellent villain, entertaining story, and brilliant arc. The best Phase 4 film by miles. Also, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is great."
Yeah, I'll tell you this. Both of those movies, Guardians 2, I reckon if I watched it again, because I remember such great things about it, like fucking Kurt Russell and all the fucking, you know, the fight at the beginning, all that cool shit. And it's only the end that gave me sort of sour taste in my mouth. I reckon if I watched it again and just understood that it had a slightly down ending, I'd enjoy it a lot more. So, yeah, it could be higher.
All right. Chris Sutherland said, "Oh, I know what my hot take is. Fucking Wayne voting Lord of the Rings on the worst Oscar movie list." Some people just carry a torch. They really do.
I understand.
Now, he's not alone, because someone was carrying a torch for me. I think it was Robert Fuller. Episode 368, movie monologues. Paul not having Army of Darkness's boomstick on his top 10 is both disappointing and appalling.
Sure.
Robert Stewart, or Stu from the Stewart Order podcast, recent guest on the show, said both of you had Shang-Chi far too low, both of you had Iron Man 3 too high.
What? Yeah, see, like, this is the thing, it's so hard with the Marvel thing, because I like them all except for 4. So, yeah, I'm in. Yeah, anything you say, I go, yeah, I could go with that.
This one, representing from Joey DiCarlo from the So Wizard podcast, wonderful show, do check them out, as well as the Stewart Order. "Paul's take on Awkwafina had me pricing out plane tickets to Australia to defend her honour."
That yeah, you hit her a lot more than
I think I would have lost that vote on that, purely on that take. Here we go. And I want to leave the final word to our friend before who we've heard from, or will hear from very shortly in just a moment, the live stream for The Cure next week. Here it is. We are almost there. We are, at time of recording, only, well, really 5, I think, days away from it beginning. Our take, or our time will be on 7 days from now. 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Australian Western Standard Time on Sunday, the 22nd of May, and that will equate to 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. time in America's on May 21st. So check us out. Come along, join the links. I'm going to have links in the show notes on how to get to live stream for The Cure for next week. So get on board. Not just our segments, which hopefully will be a lot of fun. We're going to do countdown trivia game for the hosts, and we have a bit of an ask us anything and guess Wayne's score on films, if you've ever seen my version thereof. So that'll be a lot of fun as I give him merciless amounts of shit for yet again some ridiculously hot takes that he has.
All good.
The man who convenes all this, who has raised so much money for this cause to fight against cancer, Nicholas Haskins, now of Nikolai's Kitchen. Hot takes about Marvel, cracks knuckles.
Oh no.
Endgame is bottom 5. It is.
Oh, fuck you.
Absolute garbage. His only good points are the fan servicey moments. Everything else is so ridiculously contrived and extremely poorly written.
Bloody hell, Nicholas. Why you want to try some shit like this, man? All right, go ahead. Keep going.
An absolute wet fart after the far, far, far superior Infinity War. Both Guardians of the Galaxy films are bottom 10, especially part 2, which is just absolute shit. The first one has one of the worst written villains in the entire catalogue by a country mile, and it drags down the entire film. Yeah, the team is well cast. Thor Ragnarok is not better than Branagh's Thor. I actively dislike, that they've made Thor just spout endlessly quippy dialogue since this film. For a Marvel film where the studio usually keeps a tight leash on its directors, they let Waititi have too much. It tries way too hard to be funny. And he goes on from there.
Well, someone does not like to laugh, do they? They just, you know, I mean, damn, Nicholas. We're going to sort this out live on the live stream from the Kuro. Okay, son.
Well, there we are. Maybe an extra reason to come along is the endgame debate, where maybe we can get Julio in there as well from the contrarians and just have everyone just weigh in on what's good and bad about endgame when they're really drunk on their last day of live stream for a cure, and we are hopefully somewhat with it for us. Where Wayne's going to do magic. I forgot to mention that.
Look, I haven't found that trick yet, so we'll see how this all goes, everyone.
But, well, then you better find another trick, because it's all over the Twitter. People are clamoring for this, Wayne.
You asshole, Brazil! I didn't even see you do this, you piece of shit! God damn it. Oh, well, now I know what to
could
do with my
eyes. Could purely on you if you don't raise $20,000 for the fight against cancer. All right. Okay. Well, without any further ado, then, let's get into... Thank you, everyone, for their feedback on last week's show. We really appreciate it. Let's get into the break for this week, which is live stream for the Cure. And then on the other side, or the promo for it, and on the other side of that, we're going to be doing the top 10 A24 films.
Not a year goes by that I don't hear about someone that I'm close to battling against cancer. Hello, everyone. My name is Nick, and I'm the host of the annual live stream for the Cure, a charity event going into its sixth year to help raise money for the Cancer Research Institute to fight for a future immune to cancer. This year, we're aiming for $20,000 starting on the 19th of May. We'll be live for over 45 hours with amazing content from people all over the world. It's going to be such a wonderful time. Please mark your calendars and please help us spread the word. The only way we can reach more people is with your likes, your shares, your comments, your engagement, whenever and wherever you see the event online. Together, we truly can make a difference. Let's fight together for a future where we don't have to hear stories about loved ones, family, and friends battling against cancer. Please join us May 19th in our fight for hope.
So there we are, live stream for the Cure. And the other thing that's really important to know about is whether or not, do you think indie filmmakers, Wayne, are as likely as mainstream filmmakers, or less so, to have smooth balls?
The answer is no. If you're an indie filmmaker, you don't do a lot of haircutting and showering as a rule, okay? And if you're a female
showering
indie filmmaker,
is adding to this mix.
I'm adding it to it. I mean, because, like, you know, I mean, we know a few indie filmmakers. These are not.
Have you seen Wes Anderson?
Yeah. Well, okay, so Wes Anderson is
very coiffed
thing,
and very precise coiffed? And prim and.
Yeah, but that's the other end of the indie scheme. You see, you got these you got people who actually dress up in like Elizabethan outfits. Well, that shit takes a long fucking time.
Yeah, but
so
surely
you get a shower.
Yeah, and underneath, surely.
But you also get
the
hang. Sure, but then you get the hangdog cool motherfuckers. I don't shower too often. I got 3 t-shirts. That kind of thing. Okay, and those are the type of people who need Paul. The Manscaped 4.0
lawnmower 4.0 as part of the performance package. I believe you'll find.
That's right. This thing here, which I have used on my balls in a COVID-infected environment.
Which means I couldn't do it for Wayne this week.
That's right. So and with the light that lights up your taint, it was just as easy to do myself. And frankly, I had a bit more control. I shaved a bat symbol into my pubic mound. So
oh, God, that would be a photo worth 1,000 words.
It would be. I just
especially if you're wearing your Batman
camera.
Shirt like you are now. You could just raise that bit up and just expose that pubic mound and just have,
you know,
like dual Batman symbols.
Or I superimpose the hairy Batman logo into every frame of The Dark Knight. He's just wearing that on his chest. Okay, sorry. But yes, those things were all possible because of Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0. Now, boys.
Ceramic blade, anti-technic technology, I should say.
That's right.
Waterproof, water resistant, I think is the right words there, that you can take
it in
the
shower.
And you
I did it in the shower.
Less mess, no fuss. And then on top of that, the performance package has a pair of really great boxer shorts, has a nose hair trimmer. Spoonism. Nose hair trimmer. It's the works. And ball toner, ball deodorant. Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant
work.
Stuff. We are keen users of this product. And
oh, yeah. Big
I've reached a point now where I just don't like to have really long hair down there. I just think it's unkempt, untidy, and disrespectful to my wife.
Now it's kind of a game I have with myself where I'm like, okay, well, let's just see how... it only happened yesterday that I did this, but might go another round, mate, because it's fun to do.
There we are.
And, you know, you're... Yeah, you're already watching TV in the shower. It's fine.
Yeah, you can pull that comment apart if you want to. The rest of us might listen to music, but Wayne watches TV in the shower. So, and how? What does it mean? We've partnered up with Manscaped, and this is why we're talking to you about it. It means that if you head on over to manscaped.com and you order yourself the performance package, or if you prefer just the straightforward lawnmower 4.0, and you type in what, Wayne?
CDPC20, which will give you a 20% off discount, okay?
And
right away.
Free delivery. And
free shipping right for you. Yeah. So that's all you pay, 20% less. Why wouldn't you try it out? Give it a try, folks.
Yep.
Manscaped.
And thank you to everyone who's already got on board. We really, truly appreciate that as well. All right, Wayne, A24, I have zero doubt that your list is going to be shit. Lead us away. What is your number 10 best A24 film?
Excellent. My number 10 is a film called Free Fire. Now, do you remember this film, Paul?
Yeah,
I've honestly, that's why it's number 10. It's Ben Wheatley. Okay, because I should say that I looked through this A24 film list and going, wow, there's about 20 or 30 films that I should have seen but didn't. There is, ergo, maybe not even 20 films that I have seen on this list. So my list is a little, I'm sure Paul's seen a whole lot more of these and has got a
fair
more
enough,
comprehensive
fair enough.
List.
Yep.
So that's why Free Fire is right here. Now, I'll tell you what this is, folks. It's got like Armie Hammer and Captain Marvel and like all sorts of people.
He whose name should not be spoken anymore.
That's right. That's right. And it's set in the 70s, and it's basically about the arms deal that's going down. And all these people turn up in this sort of barnyard thing, and then it just leads to a massive shootout between these two groups. And literally, the whole, like a big chunk of the movie is the shootout. So I'm like, well, that looks cool. And it actually does look cool because it's all 70s, and it's a little, I don't say Tarantino-y, but the way the styling is somewhat, it's actually quite attractive. So I'm like, cool, this is the shit. I go in, it is definitely fun. You will care a little about the characters and the situations. The first short act of the film is the setup, and it's kind of interesting in the characters and stuff, but unfortunately the only problem with it is that once the bullets start flying, you kind of, it technically jumps around and you can't quite tell where people are. It's actually not that, like, as well done as it could be. And so the towards the end, I remember thinking, I'm only hanging around to see how many people
make it
who,
out.
Who doesn't die?
Yep.
Who doesn't die, yeah. So that it does devolve into that. However, I enjoyed the actual way the film looks and how it is and kind of...
The 70s?
I don't know,
you
it was
like
a cool idea. In this case, you know, in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and this one, those are the two movies that do test 70s in a right, or a few, one of the two movies that do 70s correctly, where it's actually attractive. Because you have to, because you look at it now, it's like, what the hell is with the safari suit? But if you were back then, you understood the Shaggy Dog, you understood those fucking like flares, you know. So yeah, that's what it is. That's what I like about it. Free Fire made it classy.
Well, there's a bit of a link between our number 10s then, because my number 10 also stars Brie Larson. My number 10 is Leti Abrahamson's Room from 2015. This is the
I was too scared to see this film.
This is the film which
how was it, Paul?
Won Brie Larson the Academy Award for Best Actress in a film. And it basically follows her and her son, who's about 5 years old. Jacob Tremblay plays him. She's a kidnap victim of some guy who routinely raped her. And she became pregnant and had his son. And it's this bond that she has with this kid because she's been in captivity for years, literally
bloody
more
hell.
Than 5 years, and is trying to bring him up in this one basically room, this room where she's kept, they are kept, and the kidnapper comes in regularly, and it's her plotting escape. The first half film, into my mind, is much better, as it's all about how can she get out of there and save her son. And the second half is, once they do get out, spoilers for a film that's 7 years old, and how they can reintegrate into society, given that up to that point in time, this boy has had no one other than his mother and the father to ever interact with. So...
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's harrowing, it's well put together, it's really disturbing, which I guess again, indie films can tend to take more risks, is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly, which is commendable. It just doesn't work as well for me. But yes, that's can I ask you this? Were you satisfied with the ending, Paul?
Yeah, look, I like this film. I think it was good. I solid film, and would recommend it to anyone who's obviously it's a very difficult subject matter and it's very harrowing. But that's films should be. The fact it's, I don't believe it's technically based on a true story, but there are stories like this that have occurred. So maybe it is pulling from those.
I think a film like this and a lot of indie films, although you could argue a lot of mainstreams as well, the purpose of them, because they're not big on action and stuff like that necessarily, is that the purpose of them is to make you feel emotionally compromised at the end. I think that's what the purpose of a film like these or this is. So,
how do you mean emotionally compromised? What's your...
You need to be affected emotionally. Okay. Like whatever you walked in with.
That's different than compromise. Compromise implies you're less than you were before.
Really? Do you think it means, though, that you're not quite sure how you feel or you're thinking about how you feel or that kind of thing?
Affected, like, I agree with. The word, I'm just affected. Taking umbrage at the...
Compromised,
umbrage,
yeah.
Yeah, compromised, I'm not right. sure, but affected for sure. It wants to emotionally move you. It wants you to be in a different place than when you started watching this movie, yeah.
And that's why an emotional fraidy cat like myself tends to go towards your Marvel films.
Where you just know at the end you're going to be like, yeah, that was...
Because that's what I came for. Exactly. Good. I got plenty of other bad shit happening in life.
So. All right.
Go. Okay.
Your number nine.
My number nine is actually a documentary. Ooh. And it is the documentary Val, about Val Kilmer, which they did.
You did talk about it once on the show?
Now, it's very interesting because I had not understood that Val Kilmer was in this position. He's now got,
esophageal cancer. Condition.
Esophageal cancer. So now when he talks, he literally talks through the little thing that he holds to his throat.
Awful.
He looks pretty beat up. And just, I didn't know he had gotten here after, you know, because I still remember Doc Holliday and stuff like that, you know.
Iceman.
And Iceman, he's Val Kilmer, baby, you know. And this whole film is narrated by his son, which they show you. They don't make a secret of it. He's like narrating as Val Kilmer. He's just reading his words. And just seeing how all the cool footage they had in the past of like him and the Brat Pack and hanging around and stuff like that, it is a really cool thing to watch. And you get the total scoop on that Island of Dr. Moreau, you know, because everyone just shat on him as the worst guy to work with ever. And he just starts talking about it.
He was vying with, of course, Marlon Brando for that title on that film.
That's right. Well, Marlon Brando was just being a, you know, but this film has actual footage of his argument with John Frankenheimer. And Val sides with Marlon Brando, and you hear it. And it's like, what? This kind of shit, the saint.
Madness.
He talks about the saint.
Madness.
Yeah, because they're both crazy fucking actors, right? So but he draws the dress how everyone says he's difficult to work with and stuff. And he tries to tell his side of it. But it's a very interesting watch. So if you've got any fanhood for the guy at all, you'll buy in just because it's about him. So it's cool.
Fair enough. All right, well, my number nine is a film which people seem to love more than me. I've got to be honest. It has grown in my estimation. I do think it's a good film, but I don't love it the way that many seem to, and we'll hear some of it in the feedback at the end on the Pop 10 segment of the show. My number nine is Ex Machina.
Oh, that's my number eight.
Oh, okay. So you're around about the same
nice
level
one.
Then for
and
me.
I'm agreeing with you too. I recognize it as a good film academically, but everyone thinks this is the shit. And I was like, it's good and really well produced. And Oscar Isaacs is so cool, like in it, you know, cool as in like he works as that CEO guy who's like, you know, and Donald Gleason or whatever and stuff like that. He's your obvious like nerd guy who comes in and he's trying to be the protagonist. But it's like, looks fucking great.
Yeah, and then of course Alicia Vikander as this robot who has been brought to life and turns out, well, again, for a film that's 7 years old.
Sorry, we should sort of like, the movie is about this programmer named Caleb Smith, who is actually Donald Gleason. He gets invited by his CEO to become part of this experiment where he has to assess the artificial intelligence that they put into this
the world's
hot
first
robot girl.
Truly artificial intelligence. Yep,
that's right. And then the two men have this, and he's away in some fucking like, you know, like mansion that's off the grid kind of shit guy. And Oscar Isaac is the CEO, and he's an odd man, but you can tell what he's doing, and it's that kind of thing. So, but it's very very. For a future set thing, it's quite stylish. It's quite clean looking. Like, it's not this sort of like flashy. It's more like cerebral kind of futurism, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's very downplay. Like, it's a beautifully shot film. Like, this out of the way kind of... Imagine, I wrote in my original review, Bill Gates, Nathan, for the Oscar Isaac character.
No.
Now you probably say it's more Elon Musk, right? 7 years on.
Closer to that, yeah.
But anyway, it's beautifully shot in the surroundings and this fortress of solitude that he has.
If you had that house, man, that's so cool.
It's gorgeous.
So cool.
And Alex Garland, who has a new film coming out soon called Men, which I'm very, very keen to see, has just proven time and again to be a very different director. Very indie, but sometimes plays with some really mainstream sensibilities like sort of 28 Days Later or Dread, which he wrote and, if truth is told, probably directed that film as well. So
Aussie fella, yeah?
No, Alex Garland? Don't think so.
Oh, I'm thinking of Alex Proyas. Sorry, go on.
No, Alex Garland is British from memory. Worked a lot with Danny Boyle. So this was, I think this was his first film that he directed, and it, you know, showed a lot of poise and a lot of promise. And so now he's Annihilation, he went on to direct, and now we have Men.
That was good, man.
Coming very shortly. It's a pretty great CV, and I think this is a good film. I guess I'm not as blown away by, it's very deliberate pacing and...
Yeah, it was a little, yes, you're right. It's a little slow is the thing.
Yep.
But it is ultimately good. So yeah. Yeah, good call. Well, that's my number eight, bro. Oh, so you're
straight
your number
back to moi. My number eight is a film which I got told, unfortunately, too many times how amazing this movie was before I saw it, how it will blow your mind. It's from a director who I really like and respect. I think I've seen all of his mainstream films, which include Blue Ruin, very good revenge thriller, Hold the Dark, which is, I think, a better than it's given credit for sort of Netflix thriller as well. I can't remember if I've seen Murder Party, but this one is in between those two, and it's called Green Room. And
Green
directed
Room.
By Jeremy Saulnier. Stars the very unfortunately early departed Anton Yelchin, Imogen Poots, Alia Shawkat, and Patrick Stewart.
Patrick.
And it basically follows a punk rock band which goes to this secluded venue. Things happen there, and Patrick Stewart is kind of the gang leader of this group of skinheads that own and populate this bar. And they decide they have to murder all this band members who have locked themselves and barricaded themselves in the titular green room. And it's a survival thriller, which goes from there, which in occasional parts is quite brutal. People told me this was the most brutal film ever made. People told me this was one of the most intense films ever made. It's good. I liked it. I didn't mind the ending and how it all wraps up. But is it as good as people said? No, not even close.
Now, is this because you are a horror aficionado?
Yes.
Gets told by a layperson that...
Yes. That's, you know, yeah, I unfortunately let my expectations be built up too high.
You just... It's
otherwise,
so hard not to.
It might have been even higher on this list. So it's still a good film. I do recommend it if that kind of setup sounds interesting to you. And it does. Jeremy Saulnier is, to my mind, I wish he was making more films. I don't think he's made another film since Hold the Dark, which is a little bit of a shame, to be honest. So hopefully he'll be back in... before too long with something else. He's around about our vintage. He's got a very unique kind of low budget indie sensibility, but makes things very, very engaging.
Okay. That's a good skill set. Cool. Nice one. My number seven, I did speak about recently, but it's The Lighthouse. It's The Lighthouse.
It's higher on my list. So I'll just say, loo.
Ah, good.
But I'm really glad you liked it. I'm glad I get to mention it again.
No, I did. And it's about two lighthouse keepers stranded on an island. One is Batman, the other one is the Green Goblin. And they...
That's exactly how they dress and act in the film. Can you imagine that film?
Right.
Batman the Green Goblin.
That would be kind of cool, except less jerking off, hopefully.
and farting.
Yeah, the film... Farting, jerking off, that's this whole film. They're going mad, and slowly it's showing you how they go mad. But I think, thinking about this since when I saw it, because when I saw it, I was still like, I don't even know how this stuff gets off the ground, right? Black and white, like, you know, not, what's it, 4:3 ratio?
Yep.
That
this
movie
is as
about
indie
two...
as indie can be, directed by Robert Eggers, the director of The Northman and The Vavitch.
Right. And then I'm thinking to myself, how does this get made? Because it's a black and white thing. Yes, there's two names in it, but whatever. And then, like, now you got to go sell this out in the market. And then people are raving over it, right?
Well, critics rave over it, like...
Well, it's critically acclaimed, shall we say.
Indie film darlings really like it too.
If I'm like, yeah, that's the movie I want you to produce, I'm like...
What do you reckon the budget was on this one, Wayne? The Lighthouse?
Yeah, we talked about this and I completely forgot.
Good.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to guess now $20 million.
It's 11.
Yeah, see, it's
that's... And it made back, to make your point, $18.3 million. So,
what? That's all?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't a box office success. It was a studio like...
Look,
okay.
Double the money seems to be their rule, but that's for big tentpole films, right, where they have this huge advertising campaign. I don't think The Lighthouse had much of an advertising campaign at all coming out of A24.
No,
so I would imagine 18.3 made its money back, and that's why Robert Eggers gets something like The Northman with $90 million budget.
Well, I think I'm just impressed that it got made, and that it was impressed that it actually had this good effect upon... Well, not good, like an effect upon me, where I would think to myself normally, this thing is too weird for me. No, it helped. It kept me there. So that's already massively in its favor. Not a crap film. Sorry, a crap film would not be able to do that. So there you are.
I think this film is technically gorgeous. It's just such a marvel, and it does in that 4:3 aspect
it's gorgeous,
ratio.
Though?
Yeah, I do. I think the lighting, the stark lighting, the black and white cinematography just sells the time period. And like, yeah, there's not a lot of whiz-bang amazing camera work in this movie, but that's not what it's aiming to do. I think the score is excellent, and that booming sound mix where the, you know, the foghorn is just going off all the time in the background just really unsettles and disconcerts you.
Yeah.
And I think it just evolves, or evokes, I should say, just this feeling of dread and discomfort in a way that very few films can.
Which shouldn't appeal to me. And yet, here we are, you know? So, like, that's why the movie's better than normal. Like, it can't, if it just has one note to play, which is, I make you depressed, that is not interesting to me. However, yep. Entertain me at the same time now we're talking, and this did that. Even though it's black and white and shit, you know, it's great. That's an achievement.
Yeah, I guess we found out why. Let's not also skip over both performances. Robert Pattinson, very, very good in this movie. But Willem Dafoe is next
Willem
fucking
Dafoe.
Level.
Willem Dafoe. He when he does that yelling, it's like, fuck, he killed it.
Yep, he did. Great film. I'm glad it's on your list as well. So that's your 7, is that right? Or was that your...
My 7.
That was your 7. My number 7 is a film you haven't seen, Wayne. It's called The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
Directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, the guy who would go on to do the one with that one Olivia Colman, The Favourite, and with Emma Stone in that movie as well, and Rachel Weisz. Very good film too, if you haven't seen that. In fact, geez.
The Favourite?
Yeah. Is that one an A24 film? If so, maybe it should have made my list. Anyway.
Yeah.
He is a very strange sort of Greek director. Directed another one on my honorable mentions called The Lobster. I also quite liked that movie.
I did not like
that. Yeah, fair enough. Going, yeah. That's very much a how do you that's a Marmite film. You love it or you don't.
They killed the dog, Paul. That's why I didn't.
Yeah, okay. Well, The Killing of a Sacred Deer is basically follows Colin Farrell and his marriage to Nicole Kidman, and they've got a couple of kids who are, you know, teenagers, 15 and sort of 18-year-old teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
He's a successful surgeon, and Barry Keoghan, he was in Eternals.
Yep.
He comes into his life. Oh, yeah, potentially the Joker. That's a better call. Thank you. And basically says to him, they become friendly. And then the younger boy gets really sick, and Barry Keoghan's character, Martin, says, you actually operated on my father after an accident. My father died, and I know it's your fault. If you don't kill, this has got to be eye for an eye. If you don't kill one of your family members, they're all going to get sick in these three stages, and they're all going to die.
Why?
Because he wants revenge. He wants revenge. Somehow.
No, how?
Well, we don't.
How is he able to control
them? The film never really tells you this. The film never tells you. Has he cast a spell? Is this a world where curses work? He just says this is the way that it is. And of course, Colin Farrell's character doesn't believe him until then. The daughter gets sick as well and starts to follow through the same stages. And the mum, through Nicole Kidman, manages to ascertain through particular machinations of the film, which I won't go into, that this seems to be legit. And it's basically, how does this family, in particular Colin Farrell's surgeon character, how do they deal with this? And how far will they go to stop, or he go to stop this from happening?
Okay, so now I'm
I don't
intrigued.
Want to spoil any more than that because
all right,
A, you haven't
like...
seen it, and B, if you haven't seen it, because this is not a well-seen or widely seen film, I should say, watch it. It's very good. It's a little longer. It's 2 hours long, but it's worth the journey, even though I'm not going to tell you, Wayne, it's going to leave you with a happy smile on your face, okay?
God damn it. I'm trying to get that out of you. I'm sitting there going, okay. The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yep.
Because that is quite the conundrum, Paul. There's a lot of research to do. Like, okay, listen, are you a witch or something? Because that means if I kill you, this might stop. So, I don't know. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil any more than that. I could tell you.
All right.
And I think you'd be really intrigued with the way the film does conclude. So I'd say that to all the listeners out there as well who have not seen or maybe even heard of this one.
All right. Okay. I got the vid. Maybe I'll just, you know, maybe I'll put something nasty on.
Check
we'll see
it
how we
out.
Go.
Yeah. Well,
all right, man.
You got time to watch it, man. Now's the time to catch up on some of this.
True. Okay, cool. My number 6 is Everything Everywhere All at Once.
That's my number 5.
That's your number 5. Mm. Okay, so everyone, just in case you don't know, and how couldn't you? This thing is everywhere. Well, maybe you don't. Everyone, it's about Evelyn Wang, played by Michelle Yeoh. She's an aging Chinese immigrant who lives above a laundromat that she owns with her husband, who is short round. And she discovers a multiverse filled with thousands of versions of herself, which is, it's a long story, but it is also a very mixed up story. I have many people come back to me and say, I like this film, but I don't know why and I don't know what happened. And I went, uh-huh. And that's actually quite an achievement, if you ask me, if you're a filmmaker. What's great about this film, for me, it's actual best achievement is that it is an indie film, which obviously has a fairly shoestring budget. And what they did was there are no props in the show. There's no, you know, like everyone, the prop that's supposed to get you between dimensions and stuff is just a Bluetooth headset. And they're just like, bing, it happened. Do you know what I mean? And that's fine. They can do that because it's this kind of show. The martial arts in it was okay. It wasn't exemplary.
I was way better than I was expecting.
Was it? Okay. Yeah, I mean, you get Michelle Yeoh and stuff like that. Interestingly for you, Paul, the daughter character was going to be played by Awkwafina. Oh, God. She eventually lost that role to the Kelly
great,
Sue.
Great decision by yeah, to get see? Stephanie Sue in the game instead.
I would love if she was in this movie. Sorry, and Joey. Paul saw it. See if he liked it still if he was in there, yes. But no, it's great. It's great to see, you know, fucking Data back in action. I just loved seeing that kind of crap happen. And even though it's like, you know, and Jamie Lee Curtis as well, doing really, really great stuff.
Doing something very different. Very, very different in coming towards, I guess, the twilight of her acting years. Great. Dan Kwan and Daniel Shunnett, the Daniels as they style themselves. Mm-hmm. Just really inventive, really quirky, really different film. Does it all work? No, I don't think so. There are people, including our good friend B Dizzle from the We Watch the Thing podcast, who said this is the best film we've seen in the last 5 years. Did not speak to me at that level or in that particular way. But I think it's a triumph of low budget. I say low budget. It's a $25 million film. It's not that low, especially by A24 standards.
True. I reckon almost every one of these indie films, and probably a lot of the mainstream ones I see, could use what I would call a 25-minute editor. There should be a guy in Hollywood where his job is, I'm going to walk into your movie in the final cut right before picture lock, and I'm going to take 25 minutes out.
Well, what if the film's 95 minutes better. Long?
I mean, let's... This film is
15 minutes long. I 100% agree. It does outstay its welcome. It does reemphasize its...
That was the problem with the
many
film.
Many points over and over again. There are film critics who point to the rock scene, I'll just call it that, it's too new to spoil, and just say how amazing that is. I'm like, yeah, it was good the first 3 or 4 times we went back to it. The 7th, 8th, and 9th time, I was getting a little long. It's made its point now.
There was a scene where Evelyn Wang was just a fucking vase, like an urn, and she was doing much the same thing. They cut that in the end. So it's like, you know, trust me, they probably had the 25-minute guy come in, and that's why it got to this.
Maybe they had 180 minutes or at least 165 minutes or 55 minutes to start with. So, yeah, look, very, very intriguing film. I love the ambition here is what I really appreciate, that they really just went for it and thought, you know what, fuck it, let's just put it all up there on the screen. Let's just include every idea and thought that we've had in some ways because we can represent it in different multiverses. And I think the real star of this film, other than Michelle Yeoh, who is excellent, and Kei Huai Quan, a short round, who's also just as good, is the editor, Paul Rogers, who must have spent fucking decades editing this movie. There are so many
those,
edits in this film.
The quick cut scenes that go on forever. Holy shit, that would have taken months, man.
Incredible effort. So absolutely, it's a miscalculation, I think, to have released this film in April/late March, depending when you saw it. I think this film may well have made a dent at the Academy Awards had it come out later. Not saying best film or anything crazy like that, but maybe there have been a few nominations for the technical side. Maybe also
this,
for
something
Michelle
like
Yeoh.
Something like this could have made a nominee, I reckon.
Yeah, nominee.
Hollywood likes to do that every now and then. So, you know.
All right, cool. That is your 6 and my 5. So my 6, then, the one we skipped over, is a French film from controversial filmmaker Gaspar Noé. It's called Climax. I did speak about it once on the show before. This film,
refresh my memory.
This film is basically a whole bunch of young dancers gather at an empty school building on a cold and wintry night to rehearse. And so the first 20 minutes of this film is basically one or two shots. Oh, there's a whole bunch of interviews with all the dancers, first of all. Very short, quick snippets of an interview. And then we get this like 12-minute shot, which is them doing their rehearsal. And the camera goes in between them and around them and up over the top of them. It is gorgeous. Wow. And then what happens after that is over, one of the people there laces their drinks with LSD. And
everyone's drinks or their drink?
Chaos ensues.
Really?
Is the best way to describe it. Most of this is shot in this really hypnotic kind of lots and lots of one shots with the camera, steady cams hovering through and amongst all the carnage and the chaos which does ensue afterwards.
Bloody hell.
It's only 97 minutes, but it feels longer, but in a good way is the way I would describe that. Not in a, it outstays its welcome. But
all of the students get LSD.
Yeah,
right?
And if they don't, there's a few that don't drink the sangria or whatever it is that they were drinking or whatever, the punch bowl.
How old are they?
I mean, they range in age from, I guess they'd be 18 through to maybe 30, 35. They're sort of, you know, youngish for the most part. And the only name actor, is Sophia Boutella from Kingsman, the blade legs. Everybody else, that just actually dances. And so when they are dancing, it's authentic and real. And you're like, whoa, damn, that's some talent there. Probably.
Wait, you like dancing scenes?
Well, but because it's this big performance and it's so well shot, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
but
no, again, no, means
not because
it
they burst
well
out into dance and there's still, no, it's a practice,
yeah, yeah.
It's
there's
a rehearsal
context
for an actual event.
Of course.
And
of
all
course
the interviews at the start end up playing out in a way through the course of the film. Like, that's how we set up our characters and their responses to the LSD and some of their reactions are all contained in those interviews. So it's a very clever film.
Climax.
I love the shit out of it, but some people, it's a Marmite film as well. You love or hate it, so yeah.
Okay, it's called Climax. So does someone come?
I'd absolutely be sure there's sexual assaults that happen once the LSD gets ingested, but I can't
remember
that off the top of my head.
Oh, okay. So no.
Actually, there is all one. Right. There is one. Yes, I'm pretty sure. Yep.
Blam. Okay. All right. I would not have known that had you not talked about it. So I'm glad you did. Well done.
Thank you. What's your five?
Well, you're about to freak out at my five because it is Hereditary.
Yeah, super low.
Yeah. Low. I thought you'd freak out that I had it at all, man.
I'm happy it's on your list.
All right, everyone. Now, Hereditary did fuck with my head and heart. It's about a family haunted by an evil presence after the death of their secretive grandmother. Turns out the secretive grandmother is a cult-ass bitch and has all kinds of shit going on trying to get this motherfucker from the other end to materialize into Earth, and she's using motherfuckers around the place, and she gotta try and possess motherfuckers. And it's a very scary film, and there's a very beheady theme in the film. There's a lot of beheading of things and people going on. It is quite unsettling, and I think what... This is one of the reason this is on my list at all. And five, yes, sure, but like for me, you know?
Yep.
It's because I...
It was too much to ask for it to be high. Unless you're right. I should acknowledge,
like,
that.
Well, it has such an effect upon you, or me at least, that I'm sitting there just not actually enjoying my time in the show, but walking out having been glad that I sat through it so I could talk about it. Because, and a film that does that has got something. Okay, it's not my thing and it's not my jam and I'll never see it again. But this obviously has done something that a lot of horror movies trying to do the same thing haven't been able to do. And that is just be a compelling story. A compelling, horrible story. And like, just the image of, shall we say, someone sawing
their own head off.
Their own head off, right? From suspended is so horrible to look at. And it's played like that as well. And I'm just going, oh my fucking God, looking at it while Paul laughs. So
I didn't laugh at that point because I was too invested in the film.
It's good, but it's horrible.
If I can now build on that, as the horror film fan on this podcast, and anyone who listens will well and truly know, this film is, I think, brilliant in what it does. It could be read up to a certain point of the film as a study of grief.
Sure.
It is this character study of how this family, Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne, and why I can't remember his name off the top of my head because he is fantastic in the movie as well, Alex Wolff, and Millie Shapiro, how these four people are trying to grieve the loss of their grandmother. And then it slowly evolves into this dread-inducing horror when in a particular other character does die as well. And I'm being vague for spoilers for a film that's 4 years old, but as Wayne was too. This film sticks with you.
I still remember shit about it.
The dread element of this movie, which grows and grows throughout, and then I wouldn't say it is cathartically released because it's not like this film ends in a happy place, nor should it. It does not demand that from the film. Like, there are some films which don't feel like they earn their shit outs or happy ending. This film... its ending is 100% earned and it ends where it needed to. The further I went from this film, the more impactful it kind of became for me. And I really warred with my one and two because I think I went on record saying my number two I liked more at one point. But the one that sticks in my head, the images that stick in my head of my one and two, and you'll understand why I'm comparing them when I get there, is Hereditary. And yeah, that's why, look, I may as well just spoil it because I have. But it is my number one favorite A24 film. And the one which I have watched twice, and I will happily again in the not too distant future. If my daughter ever gets into horror films, I'll watch it with her again. Otherwise,
oh my God, don't do that to her.
No, we're not when she's nine. When she's 16 or 17 or 18, you know what I mean?
Like, too young.
But the point is, me. that this film, I think, deserves to be seen. It, to my mind, is the perfect blend of, we've got some mainstream, so to speak, names and talent here with a first-time director who knocks it out of the fucking park with this.
Was this his first time?
Yeah, Ari Aster. With
bloody hell.
Some incredible shots, and just the atmosphere this film brings is just second to none.
Toni Collette's good, isn't she?
Toni Collette,
she's a good,
was
snubbed. A good actress.
You know, yeah. You ever go back in time, and what's a horror film where the lead actor should have been nominated for an Academy Award, at least nominated? This is the film. Toni Collette is next level in this movie. And I hear she's not a very nice person. I've heard that from several different sources.
Really?
Yeah, which is a shame. Yeah, that's just hearsay. That's a shame. She might be the most lovely person in the world, just rubbed a couple of people's noses the wrong way. But regardless, she is a talentful person who deserves all the accolades that could come her way.
Fair enough. Hereditary, everyone.
Right, your five, my one. What's your number four, Wayne?
My number four is The Disaster Artist.
Exactly where it fell for me. I thought really, this was your number one.
This is a good ass show, man. This is great. A good ass show. Like, I didn't, as a guy who, I'll tell you what, okay, so the original fucking, you know, what's it called? The Room,
the
okay?
Room.
I was
not Room.
Introduced.
The
not
Room.
The Room, right. The Tommy Wiseau thing. I was like shanghaied into seeing that out of cinema with the, you know, with the old, with where they throw the cutlery and they boo and this and that, which I'd never been to a show like that before. So fine. That was years and years ago, right? And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And then it became like this joke about the Room meeting. Shanghai. I'm sure that's an accepted term. But now it means locked in. All right. and so when I saw this movie, first of all, I love Seth Rogen. We didn't know anything about James Franco at the time, you know?
Yep.
And the way that this film is put together and the fact that it has, I don't know, like, it's just weird. First of all, I hate Tommy Wiseau. I think he's a fucking asshole, all right? Like, so that's
Whoa.
Just that. I don't actually like to celebrate that, but the fact that this thing actually came off the way it did, despite James Franco being so much taller than Greg Sestero's character, like, his brother, whatever, it was just hugely enjoyable. So a big fan of this show. Big fan.
I think what really works about this movie is that they recreate the scenes in the room so well and then show you the story of what happened behind them. Whether or not it's complete fiction or fabrication, it's entertaining. And
oh yeah,
you really must watch The Room before you see The Disaster Artist to get the full effect.
Totally, totally. Oh, hi, Mark. Like, yeah. That stuff is
all
just
that
like,
stuff is just great. Like, why are we on this roof with this CG in the background? No, no, this is the way I have to do it. Eh? You know, like, what? What? And then Seth Rogen, everyone's just scratching their heads like, what are you doing? Why are you spending so much money on this shit? Where is this money coming from? All these films, these questions get asked in this film. And it's really fun. It's so laugh-out-loud funny at times, this movie.
He's so lucky that, like, those college students picked up The Room and decided to make a thing out of it and then have a movie night. Then it became famous. Otherwise, this is just another bag of shit you wouldn't even look at somewhere else. You know, and it's just, I don't know. It's sort of, I still wonder where he got his money from. I do want, because they never reveal that.
No, and even he hasn't revealed it. So,
yeah.
So good stuff. Nice pick at number four. I have to agree, for obvious reasons. What's your number three?
All right. Number three is... let's see how Paul feels about this. Enemy.
Yeah, no. Not okay. Not even getting mentioned on my list.
I didn't think it would. Everyone, Enemy is a movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and who else is in it? I did not write it down.
Top quality podcasting. Why would you go anywhere else? Melanie Laurent from Inglourious Basterds, she was in. And Sarah
right.
Gordon and Isabella Rossellini, yeah?
Isabella Rossellini, yes, exactly. So this is the oddest film ever, everyone. And I'll be honest with you. The only reason I saw it is because I had someone sell it to me like this. They said these exact words. Wayne, the ending of that movie will fuck you up for life, is what they said.
But yet you are the man who doesn't want to walk away from a film feeling bad.
The guy who said it was a little like me. And he said it he was enthusiastic about it. He said, no, don't worry about it, but you need to have this experience. And I'm like, okay.
We actually had to watch it for the patrons. One of the patrons directed us to watch this a couple of years back, maybe 3 years back.
Yeah, I remember, but I was like totally disinterested until I told someone I was going to watch it and they said that. I'm like, okay. So this is about the lives of two identical men with two distinct personas who become intertwined. However, through the film, you're not quite sure what the fuck's going on. Mm-hmm. And there's a real undertone of sexuality and a spidery theme and all sorts of things, which is why I know it's not on Paul's list.
Yeah, that's primarily the reason.
It is, but it is straight up freaky. It is definitely worth a watch. If you're in the mood for some surreal thinker kind of shit, the theme of the film is essentially about a man's subconscious and how he deals with the ideology of remaining faithful to a woman when he's forced with the pressure of becoming like a dad himself. And it's about a man, or this man's at least, struggle to reconcile the irresponsibility of cheating on his pregnant wife with the reality of knowing that he has to grow up and stop cheating. So it's very compelling.
Do you think Wayne read that out? Because if you do, you're correct.
I had to write it down because it's hard to do, man. Like it's
a deep film for sure.
Ton of chatter, and like for Denis Villeneuve, this guy here, right? This is an example of him just writing himself into a, not a corner, but it's so complex, this film, and has so many layers, and it would be so hard to plot into an actual movie, and he's done it and he nailed it. And then the ending does take one by surprise, is all I will say. I think you should watch it. I think you should try not to spoil it for yourself. Give Enemy a try if you're not Paul.
Yeah, or arachnophobic. I think that's probably the other thing we should emphasize. All right.
Yes, good point.
Gary, I'm going to bounce back to you. My number three is Where I Had the Lighthouse from Robert Eggers. Yep.
Very much. Now, this number two of mine is The Florida Project.
Oh, I shot that off at the very last second. It's my number 11. I'm surprised. Dude, you like this one so much.
I am too, because I remember when you told me about it, you said you check this out, yada yada, and I watched it, and I actually was looking through it, going, oh, what a nicely shot film because of all the colors. It's shot in Florida, so there's all these buildings like bright pink and bright blue and stuff like that, and it's kind of cool. And it's about this 6-year-old girl who lives with her unemployed mom in Florida, and they try to stay out of trouble. They try to make ends meet. And she's got best friends and they forge adventures. And Willem Dafoe is the caretaker, yep. I guess.
Who's kindly sort of, caretaker.
Kindly caretaker. He actually looks after the kids when, like, you know, predators come around and stuff like that. And it's right next. It's contrasted because it's right next to where they live, is right next to Disney World, which is this beautiful place and yada, yada, yada. I think what I love about the film was I initially watched the whole thing and said, what's the fucking point? Because it ends in a very odd way, where the film changes really dramatically and the last scene is something you're really not expecting. Then I was like, what does that mean? And I started it's one of those things where you read about it and it's like, well, what does everyone think happened at the end there? Because it ends abruptly, right? But
What was the general take on how it ended?
The general take, I'll just tell you what it is, okay? Spoilers, everyone.
Yeah, it's old film now. Yeah, 5 years.
Yeah, at the end, like the movie, what happens is the young girl has to leave or something. She goes out to see her friend, and everyone's really upset. It's a really horrible situation. We have to leave now. We can't be together anymore. And the lead girl just grabs.
They run into Disneyland, don't they? Or Disney World.
Yeah, they run to Disneyland, and what happens is the camera changes to like 35mm because you can't film anything in Disney World. So they shot that whole part with an iPhone. But what it is the scene is them right. They just run into Disney World, and it's just so happy looking, but odd, but happy looking, and very child jarry kind of running everywhere kind of thing. And the idea here is that was them, the girl taking her away and saying, we're in a horrible situation. We're having some horrible shit happen about to us. Let's just run away to the castle, to the Disney, to the fantasy. And you're not actually supposed to, the director says, think that, oh, well, this means that they somehow disappeared to a magical place.
No,
these two kids.
The film's no, very
he said
realistic.
No. He said, "This is not. You're not meant to think about. Oh, what happens now? You're just meant to think. Well, if you're looking for a good, nice, happy ending to this film, the only one available to you is the one inside these kids' heads. That's what he's saying. You know. But that is so fucking cool. Like, and it's left up to interpretation. It's not supposed to be literal. But
again,
holy
it's a downer anyway, and you're getting behind it. So,
But for it to impress me in its format so much, where I had to think about it, then I had to look at it, then I watched it again as a result, that's pretty cool. So, The Florida Project should not have worked for me, but it did. Hence, I was impressed, you know? So there you are.
All right. Well, I'm
there you go.
Quietly pleased, less impressed by this number two for you. Caught me out. Yeah. We haven't heard your number one yet, have we?
No.
And I ain't gonna be my number two either. So my number two. Is Ari Aster's other film, Midsommar, which was my favorite film of 2019. But
yeah,
I've decided Hereditary pips it at the post. Look, this film is an excellent slow burn folk horror, right? So think Wicker Man, but translated or transported into sort of Sweden And it's this horror film which takes place almost entirely in daylight. There's nothing about...
That's the most interesting thing about this. Yeah,
shadows and darkness here. There's so many little visual flourishes. The characters use drugs at a certain point, and there's this, to represent that, there's this little like flowers blooming and wilting in the corner of the screen. And whatever. It's never drawn attention to. You've got to kind of notice that yourself. So there's this unsettling tone. But it opens with this absolute killer moment, which knocks you off balance, and you never really recover. Even though, if I had a complaint and what keeps it at number two rather than being my favorite, probably it's middle 15-20 minutes, a la Your Rule, Wayne. Had that guy come in and cut out 20 minutes of this middle section, would be a much better film. Or that much better again. Not a much better film. It would be a 4.5-star film rather than a 4-star film, which is where I kind of have it. It is impactful. It lingers in the mind. Again, like Hereditary, like Ari Aster has this capacity to get under your skin. And really, at its core, this film is about the end of a relationship and how two people who weren't really suited for one another should not have stayed together as long as that they did. And the horror which comes as a result of that.
So it is a horror pill.
Oh, yeah. It's a horror movie through and through.
It's definitely a horror. And is it gore horror?
There are moments of gore horror. Not
right.
Probably a lot like Hereditary. Few and far between, but when they come, they're very impactful.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I hear a lot about this film. So, yeah, you're not alone. Okay,
fantastic film. Do check it out if you haven't seen it. Although, again, even for reading through our comments on today's topic, some people hate this film with a passion. So, it's another Marmite film. And maybe that's that's what we're discovering. Maybe all films are Marmite films, really, because there are a subsection of people who will love something and will hate it, and others who will hate it. Anyway. Mm.
Okay, nice one. Well, we're going to go 10 to 1 for me then.
Yep,
please. Number 10, Free Fire. 9, Val. 8, Ex Machina. 7, The Lighthouse. 6, Everything Everywhere All at Once. 5, Hereditary. 4, The Disaster Artist. 3, Enemy. 2, The Florida Project. And my number 1 is, Paul would not have this on his list, but it's Uncut Gems.
No, of course.
Not Uncut Gems. Now, everyone. So Uncut Gems is about Adam Sandler, who plays a jeweler. And he's a gambling addict in New York, and he has to retrieve an expensive gem that he purchased to pay off some of his debts. And it becomes a very, well, here's the thing. I was like, oh, Adam Sandler's doing a drama now, so let's just see how this goes. what I was not expecting is this movie is just anxiety fuel. Like, that's what the whole point of the film is. Yes, it's ostensibly about this dude. And yes, it's a bit of there's gangsters here and there. And he's like, you know, he's a jeweler. He's in that world. But every scene is so kind of like anxiety-inducing, I guess, is and just him getting thrown out of the car or almost getting killed, it goes on and on and on. And the whole thing about this film is that. It's like, I'm going to keep this particular like emotional sort of like frail kind of shit going on with you the whole movie, which I was quite surprised to have enjoyed. And there's some, it's harrowing, but not gory. It's like intense and realistic and dramatic. And it's a little bit in spirit similar to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and so that it's following just one person around town, essentially. But way more stuff happens in this film than in the other film.
Ironically, the other film is way better than this one.
I will agree. But here's the thing. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when I first saw that, I will admit to you folks, I was like, fuck this shit. Like, this took too long. This guy is really having a problem with himself. Jesus, Quentin, can't you just, you know? And then I saw it again and I was like, oh, I see it now. You know, you have to know it's coming, and you have to understand and roll with the punch of the long drives and shit like that. This film here, when I saw it, straight away liked it. So, you know, having said that, haven't seen it again since. But it's just well constructed, and it's... You can tell that they really put their heart and soul into each scene to try and script it in a way that makes you do that. So, kind of masterful, I would say.
Wow. That's a big favorable review for a film which I thought was okay. It was okay.
I remember
watching it just going, wow, Wayne talked this shit up so hard.
Again, I think if I hadn't, you might like it more. I'm just saying.
Maybe. All right, just revealing then my 10 through 1, really, because you've already heard it. Number 10, Room. 9, Ex Machina. 8, Green Room. 7, The Killing of a Sacred Deer. 6, Climax. 5, Everything Everywhere All at Once. 4, The Disaster Artist. 3, The Lighthouse. 2, Midsommar. And my number 1, as mentioned, Hereditary.
Alrighty.
So, 1-2 punch for Ari Aster at the top of my list. Wayne, very quickly run down any honorable mentions you have not yet had a chance to.
Only one was the De Palma documentary. I really liked it, but I was sitting there going, I wonder if the interviewer is going to say, how come you suck now? and they didn't actually do that.
So the podcast in Australia called the Countdown, which has given you credit for a term they call departed, where you once were great and now suck.
That's right, man. It's like, how come you learn to eat shit so well now? I don't know. It's just, it's so, that's it. But yeah, that's the only one. You?
My honorable mentions, I said the Florida Project, I said the Lobster, and my only other one, Lady Bird, which I quite like that film too.
Would you recommend I watch Lady Bird? I have not seen it yet.
Yep.
Definitely. Okay, cool.
Performances are good enough. There's some good comedy in there. Sweet family interactions. See it.
Done and done.
All right, that's Alice. What about yours? We wrap up every episode in a show, in a segment of the show that we call the Pop 10.
Talk about Pop 10. Talk about Pop 10.
Kicking off this week's Top 10 with a top level patron and moderator of the Facebook community, listener community, David Powell, who said, I believe I warned you that a top three was a ridiculous ask for A24, and he proceeded to give 10. Well, here's his three. Number three, Midsommar. Number two, Ex Machina. Number one, The Vavitch.
The Witch?
Yep.
Is that shit?
I didn't like it very much, but David loved it.
This man is a connoisseur.
Yeah. B. Dizzle, the aforementioned from the We Watch the Thing podcast. Number three, again, Midsommar. Number two, The Lighthouse. Number one, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Number one.
He loved that film. Matt Evans, who I went to primary school with. Hey, Matt, how are you going? Number three, Green Room. Number two, Hereditary. Number one, The Lighthouse. So both on both of our lists. Scott Thornton, number three, Uncut Gems.
Nice.
Number two, Hereditary. And number one, Ex Machina. I watched this not knowing anything about it and was blown away. Bloody brilliant film. Tom Ashdown said, this was hard. Number three, Green Room. Number two, Hereditary. And one, Ex Machina again. Adelaide Spence had Ex Machina for the third person in a row. Moonlight, first mention thereof of the Academy Award winning film. And Eighth Grade, no order particularly given. All in my top 100 films of all time, said Adelaide. So, wow.
Can I ask, have you seen Mid-90s?
No.
It's a Jonah Hill one. No. I really wanted to put that in. I just haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Jesse Dixon said, can't wait for this episode. Number three, Hereditary. Number two, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And number one, Midsommar. Whoa.
Wow.
Jonathan Lamb said, this was super hard. Tusk, just kidding. Please don't go in this one. Number three, Moonlight. Love the sensitivity that Barry Jenkins brings to this story. Number two, The Farewell, a film I haven't seen. Love the sentimental and touching comedy so much as it really hits home for me as an Asian immigrant. Makes perfect sense. And number one, Everything Everywhere All at Once. There's definitely a bit of recency bias here, but this movie is a modern classic to me. What a great description there. Thank you for that, Jonathan. Gerald from Two Peas on a Podcast, who we'll be hearing next week on live stream for The Cure. Number three, Wayne, Uncut Gems.
What up?
Number two, Hereditary. And number one, The Vavitch as well.
Do you say that because it's two V's?
Yeah.
Instead of a W?
Yeah.
It's fucking weird.
David Breyer. Very difficult. But number three, Killing of a Sacred Deer. Number two, Hereditary. Number one, Midsommar. So just had the opposite way around for me at one and two there, David. Nice choice. And lastly, the aforementioned at the top of the episode, Joe Doherty, who wrote us an email, said, this was hard to cut down to three, but number three, Uncut Gems. Number two, Moonlight. Yeah. And number one, Green Room. And that is it for the Pop 10. Thank you to everyone who got back to us. We're sorry we couldn't get to you all for this particular occasion. We really, truly do appreciate it. Now, Wayne, we haven't got episode 373 organized as of yet.
No, life is a little bit just topsy-turvy at the moment in terms of the schedule.
And we need to let you get better and see what you can manage and what you can't manage. So let's just, we'll hold on that one and we'll let you know again in the Facebook community what the topic for episode 373 will be. So keep an eye out there. Wayne, how do the good folk get in touch with us or let us know things about the show and stuff we talk about that we should know?
Well, in a few weeks, go ahead to our website, which is... Or is it
thecountdownpodcast.com? That's right.
Okay. But not now. For now, what you want to do is you want to search Google for all of our socials, the name of the show, or send us an email at thecountdownpodcast@gmail.com.
Otherwise, check out Podbean, where we host the show. Like and follow us there. The Facebook community links in the show notes. And I think that's pretty much all you need to know for today.
Damn right.
All right. Well,
thank you very much, folks.
All the best to you, Wayne, for your recovery this week. And thanks to everyone for joining us. And that's it for us today.
Bro.
My name is Paul.
My name is Wayne.
And this has been The Soundboard, where I post it in later because I can't do it live.
Well, I'm sure you'll make a great decision.
Dynamite drop-in money at Broadcast School has really paid off.
Once again, brilliance has ensued, and we will catch you next time. See ya!
See ya.